Blog Talk Radio.
Well, this is Blog Talk Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Russ Johnson, and we have a lot of information to pass on to you, so I hope that you have pen and pencil ready. But the first thing I want to do was say that we have a new book. It's called Beyond Religion by the Dalai Lama, and I want to play a clip from that so you can understand exactly where we're going. Beyond religion.
In view of this, I am of the firm opinion that we have within our grasp a way and a means to ground inner values without contradicting any religion and yet, crucially, without depending on religion. The development and practice of this new vision of ethics is what I propose to elaborate in the course of this book. It is my hope that doing so will help to promote understanding of the need for ethical awareness and inner values in this age of excessive materialism. At the outset, I should make it clear that my intention is not to dictate moral values. Doing that would be of no benefit. To try to impose moral principles from outside, to impose them, as it were, by command, can never be effective. Instead, I call for each of us to come to our own understanding of the importance of inner values. For it is these inner values which are the source of both an ethically harmonious world and the individual peace of mind, confidence, and happiness we all seek. Of course, all the world's major religions, with their emphasis on love, compassion, patience, tolerance, and forgiveness, can and do promote inner values. But the reality of the world today is that grounding ethics in religion is no longer adequate. This is why I believe the time has come to find a way of thinking about spirituality and ethics that is beyond religion.
So, that's a big statement. The new book, again, is Beyond Religion by the Dalai Lama. And the constructs that he's talking about is just abiding, deep, and seriously, should be seriously taken to, that we should follow.
By inner values, I mean the qualities that we all appreciate in others and toward which we all have a natural instinct, bequeathed by our biological nature as animals that survive and thrive only in an environment of concern, affection, and warm-heartedness, or in a single word, compassion. The essence of compassion is a desire to alleviate the suffering of others and to promote their well-being. This is the spiritual principle from which all other positive inner values emerge. We all appreciate in others the inner qualities of kindness, patience, tolerance, forgiveness, and generosity, and in the same way, we are all averse to displays of greed, malice, hatred, and bigotry. So actively promoting the positive inner qualities of the human heart that arise from our core disposition toward compassion and learning to combat our more destructive propensities will be appreciated by all. And the first beneficiaries of such a strengthening of our inner values will, no doubt, be ourselves. Our inner lives are something we ignore at our own peril, and many of the greatest problems we face in today's world are the result of such neglect. Not long ago, I visited Orissa, a region in eastern India. The poverty in this part of the country, especially among tribal people, has recently led to growing conflict and insurgency. I met with a member of parliament from the region and discussed these issues. From him, I gathered that there are a number of legal mechanisms and well-funded government projects already in place aimed at protecting the rights of tribal people and even giving them material assistance. The problem, he said, was that because of corruption, these programs were not benefiting those they were intended to help. When such projects are subverted by dishonesty, inefficiency, and irresponsibility on the part of those charged with implementing them, they become worthless. This example shows very clearly that even when a system is sound, its effectiveness depends on the way it is used. Ultimately, any system, any set of laws or procedures can only be as effective as the individuals responsible for its implementation.
And I think Jillian talks about taking responsibility over and over and over again. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, Jillian. How are you today?
Hello, Russell. I'm fine, great. Thank you, and I hope you are.
Yes, yes, yes. Getting underway for an explanation that I'm still trying to go through and, you know, and pull out the essence of the ministry of Jesus, and I wanted to talk to you about that because I see you seem to be right on target about knowing who Jesus was, number one. That's number one. Two, his ministry and what he was here to do. So maybe that's a good way for us to start today, to delve right?
Yes, I agree. You know, there's a ground, a piece of groundwork. The Dalai Lama in that talk, and, you know, we've listen to it once or twice. He's talking about establishing an ethical principles for the people on the planet, and that is great. And what he's talking about, I don't think anybody could disagree with it. But here is the thing. The reality is that moral laws or ethical morals change with the society. What was ethical among Cro-Magnon man or the Middle Ages or the Renaissance man or the Shakespearean man or the modern man, these change. The social mores dictate the morals of the era in which we live. But there are fundamentals that never change. And of course, that most fundamental of all is that which we speak of in most religions as the idea of the creator creating our universe. So what is the first thing that we hear? Well, it's the word or the sound. The sound of the source manifested our universe. And when that sound was put into play, when that word was spoken by the source, it was followed by a law. And the law of the universe, that word is the law. And the law of the universe is order. And what do we mean by order? We mean creating balance out of imbalance, bringing things into proper order in a balanced way. Now, that sounds very simple. First, there is some source out there that we call God, and nobody knows who or what or where it is, right? But that source issues a sound wave, a frequency that manifests an entire universe. And following on that, he says, okay, this is my word, this universe, and it's all chaotic and in upheaval and constantly changing. So we need some management, and that management is order. The law is order, and the order is finding balance out of the chaos. That is the beginning and the end of any and all teachings that you ever need to know, because that applies to everything. And fundamentally, that is what Christ taught. Now, we have expanded on it. Christ expanded on it. All the great teachers expanded on it. But that fundamentally, which I just said, is all we ever really need to know, because every cell in our body is trying to find balance with every other cell to keep us healthy. Every person in their home environment is trying to create emotional balance upon the residents of the house so that they have a harmonious atmosphere to live on. Every country is trying to find balance with its relationships with the neighboring countries around it or across the water or wherever they may be. The entire planet is trying to find balance, and the entire universe is seeking balance. All nature seeks balance, from the microcosm to the macrocosm. And this is what Christ is teaching. When he came to this planet and taught us, he taught that we can do everything that he could do and more. And in order to be able to follow Christ's admonition and be perfect as our Father in heaven is perfect, which is what he told us to do, right? We have to find balance. The secret of it is balance. So what is it that we are balancing? Well, we are balancing frequencies. Everything that exists is vibrating at a frequency. Just as in the beginning, the word, the sound, the frequency flowed out in the light to manifest the universe. So everything that we pour out from ourselves every day of our lives is in the form of frequencies, and those frequencies determine our present and our future, and they are based on whether or not we have learned from our past. So if we study the past and understand it in the present, we can change it in the future. Now, this is because it's a universal truth and not just a personal truth. We can take as many eons of time as we want in order to reach that perfect balance, in order to reach that level of perfection, and in order to be creatures as Christ was, able to do the things that he could. It's not complicated. It just requires common sense. And we all have that. We maybe don't use it very often, but we all have it. There is nobody doesn't have common sense if they choose to use it. And right. So this is what all our life is about, and this is what Christ was teaching us. And then he told us the easiest way in which to do this. Fill ourselves with the frequency of unconditional love, of compassion, right? Fill ourselves with that frequency. In other words, more concern for somebody else than for ourselves. When we can do that, then we can easily find this balance that he is talking about. And what is unconditional love? It's the road, really, to the development of our soul, to the evolution of our soul. And when we finally get that balanced, then we will indeed be able to do all the things Christ can do. After all, changing water to wine, it's only a matter of changing the frequency of the water to the frequency of the wine. And that was his first, if you remember, Christ's first miracle. And these things I'm saying are not particularly related to Christ. He was the great teacher and one of the Almighty Lords who came to teach us these things, to reiterate them to us. But all the other teachers have been teaching the same things. Buddha, Confucius, Kuan Yin, Muhammad, all the great teachers who came forth for humanity have taught the same thing. And that thing that grounds each and every one of us as individuals in the microcosm is that, allowing that we don't have to balance the universe, that's God's business, that we do have to balance ourselves. And so it all comes back to going within ourselves, examining ourselves with objective honesty, and that's very difficult to do, and from that objective honesty, moving forward in truth, seeking always truth, moving always towards the light, exposing the truth of ourselves to ourselves. We're always going to hide a few things from our friends and neighbors, right? We're not going to tell everybody all our little inner secrets. None of us are going to be that brave. But to be able to know the truth of yourself, that is the foundation of becoming a being of unconditional love. And remember, unconditional love is not something you feel, and it's not something you do. It is something you are. It is the frequency of you. Your entire being becomes that frequency of unconditional love, where you really would put anybody and everybody ahead of yourself without judgment.
But that takes time.
Yes.
It takes...
can take eons. Can take lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. That's the beauty of it. There is no limit to how many lifetimes we can reincarnate and have another go at it. We can keep trying and trying over and over again till we get it right. And nothing is ever wasted.
Nothing, you say. How many incarnations have you had, if I may?
Well, the ones I remember, right, and luckily We only have a tendency to remember ones that were any use to us, which is a comforting thought. But ones I actually remember, probably not more than a dozen in the last 4,000 years or so. There may have been others that I don't remember, but if I don't remember them, then of course I don't remember them. Ones I do remember, 10 or 12.
Wow. So,
and in each one, none of our incarnations are wasted. I think that's the point I wanted to make, that no matter you get to my age, you get to be old, and you look back and you think, well, what a waste of space I've been. I've really accomplished nothing. I've done nothing. I have not maximized my abilities. I have not become unconditionally loving or non-judgmental. I'm still, you know, selfish and self-centered and want my own way. And we can recognize all these truths about ourselves as we look back over our lives. But still, the life is not wasted, because now we have at least advanced enough to recognize those things in ourselves. So no matter what life you've had, whether it's been by your perception a success or a failure, is really irrelevant, because we always learn something from the experience. And I would say this to anyone who is judging themselves, we shouldn't. We should not judge ourselves, because it is our overall soul development which counts. And this is going on and on like an everlasting spiral. So each lifetime, hopefully, we learn a little more and a little more, and expand our soul's understanding, expand our soul's awareness from each experience, whether that experience in the material world was good, bad, or indifferent. The soul can still have learned and gained something from it, and that is what is important. And I can assure you, we should not judge ourselves. Higher authority will certainly do the judging for us. There's no doubt when we get to the other side, there'll be a whole crew of people waiting to tell us what we got wrong, right? There's certainty. I can assure you that's the case. There will be plenty of people waiting to correct us on the other side. So don't waste your time down here judging yourself, but do use your time by assessing yourself and trying to correct those things which, when you use common sense, you can see are not useful in your life.
Well, I see you've done pretty good. It says here, I have the Violent Flame and other meditations. So you have a book on meditations, and it indicates that you, 30 years in teaching metaphysics, that you've written a practical guide to assist your students how to grow spiritually. And you're saying that it's not difficult, that it's not a manual of difficulty, if you will, that it's simple. You can do it in a flat 4 seconds instantaneously that you demand to get yourself to meditate. How do you do that in 4 seconds, if I may?
You just decide to do it and then stop thinking about everything else. That's all.
Okay.
That's all.
That's it.
All meditation is basically, you could say to me now, Gillian, you're talking too much, shut up. And all I have to do is close my mouth, right? Well, the same principle applies to meditation. But you're in charge of your brain. You're in charge of your mind, right? So all you do is tell yourself, keep quiet. And when thoughts come through your brain, you know, unasked, because you've told it to keep quiet, but it won't shut up, right? You just imagine it's like an empty blue sky and little clouds float across. But they don't matter. They don't mean anything if you give them no attention. So they drift away. So even if a thought comes into your mind, don't give it any attention and it will just go away. It really is simple. If you like to meditate, if you like to sit and spend half an hour or an hour moving into theta level brain waves and all the other things that you do in deep meditation, that's wonderful. But in my experience, the vast majority of people in today's world either simply do not have time to do that, or are, when they have time in the evening, they're so tired they fall asleep anyway, right? They're not going to sit and meditate for an hour. And most people, in my experience, do not have the propensity to sit quite still for a whole hour. It's not easy to do that, especially if you are in any way, shape, or form an A-type person who, like me. I want everything done yesterday. So for me, I would have to say sitting still for an hour would not lead me into meditation. What it would lead me into is annoyance, aggravation, irritation, and a sore back. So that's not what I want. But I will share this with anybody who would like to connect with spirit in a more profound way. Find the things, and are not good at sitting, like I'm not good at sitting. Find the things that you do, or that you need to do. Like maybe you have to wash a floor or clean a floor, or you have to weed the garden or rake the leaves. These are mindless jobs. They don't need any real mental attention. So just think into them, and that enables you to stop thinking. And you will immediately, if you allow yourself to, fall into a connection with spirit. Make that your intention. I discovered after many, many years of people who were coming to classes with me, asking me about meditation, I suddenly realized, hey, this is my meditation. I'm either 100% focused on what I am doing, in those cases, teaching that class and talking to the people who are doing the class with me. I'm 100% focused on the job, or I am meditating. Right now, as I have got older, one of my hobbies I've taken up is sitting knitting. So as I'm just doing knitting, going back and forth, knit a row, purl a row, knit a row, purl a row, my mind's off in the heavens. It's in the universe. It's wherever it wants to be, experiencing new experiences, pulling in information, connecting with spirit. So don't make meditation hard work. Make it a thing that is easy. And that's why I did that little meditation book, to make it easy. Let it be a joy, not a punishment.
And for the people who need to look at it, it's, again, The Violent Flame and Other Meditations by Jillian D'Amon. And that's on the website, No Hoax. And this other book that you have written is called ETA, A Future Tale. Let's talk about that. It was written from the unique point of view of the spirit. So let's talk about that book. And that's also on the website.
I have a dear friend who is another clairvoyant. She goes by the name of Sayada and has been known by that name for many, many years. And she and I had gone on several quests, if you like, by invitation of spirit to various locations, mostly Hawaii, thankfully. And we'd had some really, really interesting and intuitive experiences together. And we had pulled a lot of information about things that were happening on the planet and that were coming about. One of the outstanding things was that they told us about the space station that was going to be built very shortly. And it was not planned at that time, but they told us that we were going to have this space station up there and that it would be very useful for getting on and off the planet. So there were numerous things they told us. And so we decided we would go to Hawaii for 6 weeks and write a book. Well, when we got there, we decided that this book would be about the things that these beings, these extraterrestrials, but we didn't want to make it like a serious book on esoteric matters. So we decided to write it as a science fiction story. And that's what it is. And it turned out to be a story that there is a bit of a storyline through it, which Seda is a better writer, I think, than I am. I'm sure she is. She likes to write, and I can't type, which doesn't help. But she wrote the story, what you might call the storyline, and I filled in all the pieces of it. And so we ended up with that little book, ETA, which actually ETA stands for the Eternal Thought Advisory. And basically, it's making the idea of a connection between certain extraterrestrial beings who are always in contact with people on this planet who wish to be in contact with them and who will be helpful in giving you information and direction in your life. So it was making that connection. It also was making the connection, and this was 25 years or more ago, that we would be getting a black president. And a few years later, of course, we got President Obama in the presidential office, and that there would be an opening of connection between that president. We called him President Black, that there would be a connection between him and the extraterrestrials, which would begin to open the doorway of understanding that the extraterrestrials have always, for good or ill, interacted with our governments at the highest level, which is true. And I think a lot more of that disclosure is coming out massively today. Remember, we wrote this book over 20 years ago, so it was not common then, but it is common now. This is what is happening. So it's just really a little story. It takes 2 or 3 hours to read, but it's about that connection and also the possibility for the future where we will have the opportunity to go to a new creation on the other side of Andromeda. It's not Andromeda. Andromeda is a spiral galaxy, apparently. I didn't know that when we wrote the book, but it's apparently a spiral galaxy. And you go the other side of that spiral galaxy, the far side of it, and there is a new creation being brought into being as we speak. It's been going on for a very long time now, and it's under the auspices of the soul energy of the Madonna, the one we know as the Virgin Mary, the female, powerful female. And, of course, that energy is actually the energy of Ninhasig, the daughter of Anu and the sister of the well-known Enki and Enlil from the Anunnaki stories of Zechariah Sitchin. And she is actually in charge of that development in the new, basically a void area of space. As our universe is expanding, it's expanding into that outer rim, and a new creation is developing there. And it's designed to be matriarchal. It's designed to be, as this end, our Milky Way throughout, is very patriarchal. And we see that so much on this planet. You know, it's a man's world kind of thing. Well, our whole Milky Way is predominantly masculine dominated. This new creation is going to be feminine dominated. And it's part of the ongoing effort to bring about the balance that I first talked about in a very physically real way by balancing the energies at the two points, the north-south points, the balance points of our universe, both ends of the universe. This is an interesting experiment in physical management of energies at a universal level, and it's very exciting, really.
When you mentioned the Bible and the ladies in the Bible, what part did Mary Magdalene play in the Bible? What was her role?
Oh, to the best of my knowledge, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the Mother of Christ, and Martha, right? They were all friends and originally members of the Essene Society, which was out in the desert at the time of Christ. You know, religions, I don't know what it says in the Bible. I'm no bibliophile, so I don't know if it mentions Nazareth in the Bible. But I know the Christian story is that Christ was born and was born in Bethlehem, grew up in Nazareth. Well, in reality, at the time that Christ was born, almost 2,500 years ago, the town of Nazareth, there was no such place. It did not exist. The area where it exists today was, at the time of Christ, an Essene encampment in desert, in a desert area outside, a long way outside any towns or, you know, villages. It was an Essene community. And the people locally called those Essenes, one of their names for them was Nazarenes. And so I guess they used that word Nazarene and evolved it into Nazareth, which is a town today on the map. But at the time of Christ, it didn't exist. So he didn't grow up in Nazareth. He grew up in an Essene community in the desert. And that's fairly well documented, I believe, in some of the translations of the Dead Sea Scrolls, although I'm not personally familiar with them. I do believe it's spoken of in there. I've forgotten where we were going. Where were we going with this, Russell?
No, I was asking about Mary Magdalene, and you were telling me
Oh,
about
Mary
these...
Magdalene, yes. So my understanding is that they were the three girls, the two Marys and the Martha, were originally temple servants at the temple in Bethlehem or Bethany, right? And that they were temple virgins, you know, the Vestal virgins in the temple at the time. And that I am not sure, because it is not my knowledge, but it is my understanding that, in other words, I understand this to be correct, but I have no empirical knowledge to back it up, that Mary Magdalene actually was the bride of Christ, that she was married to the Lord. She, Martha, Martha, the Marys of Bethany, they definitely were disciples. They traveled with Christ, and they were with him, and I believe. And that contention is actually well documented in the writings in that book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which was written some years ago, 20, 30 years ago, I believe it came out. But it traces through archaeological finds and documentation that enough evidence to suggest that that is a high probability. I personally think it's correct information.
Mm-hmm. What part did Paul play in this whole thing? I mean, I know he wrote Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love. Go right ahead. What part did he play?
Right. St. Paul, well, he's a saint now, right? He wasn't, was he? He was Saul, man who was, Saul, who was speaking and doing everything he could to denounce the Christians. And then on the road to Damascus, he gets, you know, this epiphany, right? And suddenly he changes his name to Paul and becomes this great and wonderful preacher and teacher. And the result is that what we believe are the teachings of Christ are actually the teachings of St. Paul. So the words attributed to Christ in the New Testament are almost certainly valid words attributed, simply because I was told long ago that when the scribes retranslated the Bible over and over again, and it has been retranslated many, many times with many, many changes in the translations, nonetheless, the scribes took great care over the words of Christ and really tried to stick to it. So probably up to the time of the King James Bible, the actual words attributed to Christ are fairly accurate. And there is a gospel out there, the Gospel of St. Thomas, which also gives a great expansion of the teachings of Christ and is probably one of the more accurate gospels still available in print, because nobody wanted to put it in there, nobody meaning the bishop. The bishops did not want to include the Gospel of Thomas in the new Bible when they were deciding what they would teach, what they would tell the world was true and what was not. And half the people deciding that could neither read nor write, right, which is an interesting thought to begin with. But still, the Gospel of St. Thomas was left pretty much in its original documentary form and was only translated, I think, in the last 100 years or so. Fairly recent history. So it's probably one of the more accurate. However, we need to remember always that nothing that Christ said was written down at all until at least 60 to 100 years after he had died. And therefore, it was all oral memory. And most of the things that I talk about, for example, are my memories. So it's oral, it's what I remember. But I'm very cognizant of the fact that memory plays tricks, that we think we remember things and we remember them the wrong way round, or we get them muddled up, or our time context is not correct. So nobody remembers things 100% perfectly unless they have an eidetic memory. And there is nothing to suggest that the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, had eidetic memories, simply because their stories all vary a little bit from one another. So none of them can be said to be 100% accurate. So none of the Gospels that we read, I would say, that were translated after the King James Version of the Bible are probably accurate. There are too many variables in there. Again, I've forgotten what you asked me. I'm sorry, Russell, my mind.
No problem.
Wandering off today.
I was asking about St. Paul. Saul to Paul.
St. Paul, yes. St. Paul, that's right. So what we have got today presented as the Christian religion may or may not be 100% the teachings of Christ. It is certainly the teachings of Paul. It is how he decided it should be. And he changed a lot of it by his own admission to suit the audience. The references he made, the examples he made, the ideas he made were designed primarily for the Greek audience and then for the larger audience. So Christ actually told his disciples, go out and teach all nations. And he wanted them to teach what he was teaching. Well, what Christ was teaching, if you just take the words of Christ from a Bible, let's say the King James, or better yet, the Geneva Bible, if you can see a Geneva Bible, as old a Bible as you can get, just take the words of Christ, and you will find that from one gospel, it fills less than four sheets of, like a school notebook, four sheets of paper is enough to write down everything attributed to Christ.
I see.
Then
so,
you
look, like this.
Now, I mean, think about this. That's a whole gospel, and written on four sheets of, less than four sheets, three sheets of paper in normal handwriting, right? Then you think of the books that are out there by other people, including St. Paul, telling you what all this means. You've got tens of thousands, probably millions, of books that are words of men trying to tell you what Christ was saying. And this is why religions are so confusing. All religions get confused. And the same could be said, for example, of the Quran. The teachings in the surahs, the spiritual teachings, are very small. They could be condensed into a few pages. It's all the other rules and regulations that the religious teachers have decided you need to abide by to understand what the teacher was saying. In the case we're talking about, what Christ was saying. But actually, Christ said what he wanted to say in very few words. Very few words. And the most important words were, do as I'm telling you, and you can have eternal life. Don't do as I'm telling you. And when nature dies, you will die with it. Dead, gone forever. He said that to us quite plainly in one of the Gospels. He also said three times to us, everything I can do, you can do, and more. And in a few words, he told us what that means. It means pay attention to yourself, get your life in order, take responsibility for all your thoughts, words, and deeds, and get some balance in your life. Then you have progress. Then you move to immortality. Then you become an immortal being. Then you don't need to reincarnate any more times on earth. But until you do that, you're going to be like a mouse on a wheel, going round and round forever, reincarnation, die, reincarnation, die, reincarnation. It's pointless. It's because the experience of life in the physical reality, for most people, brings us a great deal of pain and suffering, as well as a great deal of joy. You know, I'm not being the half glass empty. I'm trying to be the half glass full and saying to you, you can stop this anytime you like. You can bring it to an end just by paying attention to these simple things that Christ told you. He would not have told you you could do everything he can do if he didn't mean it. He wasn't dishing you out a load of spam. He was telling you the truth. And the truth is that you are designed to have a long, healthy life on this planet, just dying of old age when you decide you've had enough, with no misery and suffering, because your body is designed to be self-healing, self-repairing, self-maintaining. And when the body is physically balanced, it does that. It does self-heal it and maintain itself as it should. That's why you see some very healthy people living to a ripe old age and just going to bed and dying one night. It's because their bodies physically are kept in a good balance, right? And we can all learn to do this by paying attention. And how do we pay attention? Well, we pay attention first and foremost by what we eat. Our body is what we put into it. If we put poison in, then we are poisoning the body. If we put healthy living things like, you know, nasty green salads that I don't care for, but if we put those into our body, that is living food that will create life within us. So always keep in mind, what you eat is what you are. Now, what I'm saying now is almost impossible to do because of the environment. We all live in a very toxic environment. The air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, none of it is healthy as it was in the days of the Garden of Eden, right? We don't have that wonderful, healthy environment. So life is a struggle for us now. But remember, we have made it that way. We have created collectively this dirty, poisonous environment that we live in. We have given the power to the authorities to stick poisonous jabs into our system and tell us that we need it and we need boosters and boosters and boosters like they've done with COVID. We have given this permission to other people to be destructive of our physical body. And it's going to take us a long time to correct that mistake, because it's a mistake we've all contributed to over the last 6,000 years. We didn't get in this mess overnight. It's taken a long time. So it's going to take us a long time to clean it up as well. But that's okay too. We've got all eternity, so we're not in a hurry. But more importantly, we can also work on our soul level. And that is something that we can fix immediately. I remember David gave me, you know, my extraterrestrial friend David gave me an instruction years ago about non-attachment. And he spelled it out, you know, that we are attached to this material world mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. And if we can detach from it on all levels so that we don't have emotional attachment to our cars, our houses, our possessions. We don't have emotional attachment to everybody we own in the way that we want to control them or own them. And we don't have emotional attachment to the certificates of knowledge that we have hanging on our walls that tell us how many degrees we've got or how clever we are. If we are not attached to these things, it's okay to have them all. But if we own them, rather than them owning us, and if we understand that all of those things are temporary, they're only there for our lifetime, and then they're gone again, and we have to start over. So if we understand that, and we don't allow them to own us, we let go of that attachment, then we can leap forward spiritually at a very accelerated rate, because then it is our soul that is guiding our life, not our attachment through the ego of the personality to the material things of this life. And once we can understand that and do it, David said to me when he gave me this instruction, he said, you know, even if you spent just 2 or 3 years of focusing in this way, you could accomplish this and become a fully enlightened being, become one of the light givers on this planet rather than one of the light takers. And he said, in fact, if somebody was really serious about it, they could do it in 2 or 3 weeks if they really, really wanted to. So this is a key. What is your, excuse me, your soul's desire?
Okay, let me play this while you take a break here. Reverend Ike has been around for a lot. He's gone now, but he was around, and he talked about prosperity mindset. And looking at the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the four Gospels that you talked about, all reference Jesus and his ministry. When you talk about the Beatitudes, when you talk about the fact that Sermon on the Mountain, he did everything in parables, but I want you to talk about that in a minute. But let me just click this off on Reverend Ike, who was very successful, but I think that he was talking about how we could be successful in this lifetime and at the same time improve our souls before we cross over.
A particular belief of mine that I have concerning the way the mind works, I believe that on the subconscious level, when a thought, when a belief registers with the subconscious, I believe that it registers as feeling. We verbalize words. We speak them verbally. We say, I am rich. That's what? Verbal. We visualize, imagine, and see ourselves as being what? Rich. That's visional. But now at the deepest of levels comes the feeling nature, the emotional level, and the subconscious receives impressions ultimately as what? Feeling. That's why I use the title for one of my series, Feeling Gets the Blessing. This is very important. So I want you to remember what the ultimate purpose of your praying, your affirming, your visualizing and your verbalizing is: induce a certain feeling. And you have not successfully affirmed or visualized or verbalized until what you are verbalizing, visualizing, and affirming or praying gets down to the level of the deep feeling nature.
I'm going to talk about John 14:12. It says, verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me, the works that I do shall he do also, and greater works than these shall he do, because I go unto my Father. And whatsoever you ask in my name, that I will do, and that my Father may glorify the Son who is in heaven. So you want to address that at any form, any fashion? Are we on the same page?
Right. Yes. I would like to talk about that. Just let me make a note here. That last little thing you said thing you said, Russell?
If you shall ask anything in my name, I would do
yes,
it for you.
It. Ask in my name. Okay, I'll get to that in a minute. Okay, first of all, I want to go over what that man was preaching about, right? Because he was talking about being rich. So the first question one has to ask yourself is, what constitutes being rich for you? Rich connotates just money in the bank and cars and yachts and possessions, right? Then you're in the attachment mode. If that's what constitutes richness in your mind, then you're in the wrong mode altogether, right? To go anywhere spiritually, right? Because you are measuring your richness. Instead of measuring it in terms of love and friendship and friends and people you care about and the things you are physically able to do to help other people, that's your richness. That's where your richness truly lies. Now, am I saying that there's anything wrong with having all the cars and so on and so forth? You know, I would be very happy if I had $10 million in the bank and could be spending this winter cruising the Caribbean instead of freezing here in Montana. Right? That would be a great joy to me, no doubt about it. But I'm not attached to it. It's never my craving. It's never my deepest desire. And the last words I said before, I think, were, you have to ask yourself the question, what is my soul's deepest desire? If your soul's desire is for abundance, in the sense of material goods, if that's what your soul desires, then by all means, when you pray, ask for it. And Christ in his goodness, or the powers that be upstairs, if you ask in his name, undoubtedly, ultimately, you will get it. There is, of course, always a price to pay for everything that we ask for, especially if we ask for it for ourselves, right? So if we are asking for a pile of money for ourselves, we are going to pay a price for that one way or another. We may get the money, but there will be a tab at the end. And at least the tab will mean another reincarnation necessary to shape up our ideas into better thinking. That's for sure. There is nothing wrong with having an abundance of everything good in this world that exists for our enjoyment and pleasure and for the fulfillment of our lives in the happiest way possible. There is nothing wrong in that at all, provided it does not come at the price of our soul and it does not come at the price of somebody else's life or somebody else's life's energy. So how we get all this wonderful abundance is very, very important. Do I think it's appropriate that we pray for it, that we ask the creator of everything that exists after everything that he's given us for free, like our lives, right? We also want to pester him for a new car and a promotion at work and more money in the bank. This is not appropriate if you are serious about your spiritual evolution. So understand that you have the skills and abilities already gifted to you to achieve for yourself anything that you wish to achieve in the material world. The better question to ask is, how do you determine what you need in life, as opposed to what you want in life? Sort those things out first, and then start asking the creative forces and the powers of spirit and your guardian angels and whoever you pray to, start asking them to help you fulfill your needs, not your wants. The wants are a whole separate issue that you can really do without. And the thing is that if you are praying for them, you are, as that gentleman was saying, you are expressing an emotional desire for things. And he used very much this idea of the emotions attached to the subconscious and the subconscious experience things in an emotional way. Well, I would disagree strongly with that. I don't think he's... I happen to think that he's on a really misleading track with that idea when it comes to spiritual development, because it is the emotions tie us to the round of reincarnation. And when we have emotional connection with our subconscious, when our subconscious is influencing us through our emotional body, that is what is keeping us tied to this wheel going round and round and round. It is our lack of control of our emotions, our lack of self-discipline, which causes us to not appropriately take responsibility for ourselves, to not behave in an appropriate way, which will lead us to fulfill Christ's teaching of be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, to be distorted in our approach so that we never quite achieve that ability to do the things that Christ did in the way that he did them. He's not asking us just to copy him. He's asking us to be him. He's asking us and telling us that we can change our entire being, whether it is alive on this planet or it is in the spiritual state after this physical body has died and gone to the other side, that we can still have the same being, be the same person. In other words, we can become immortal. Christ is teaching us the road to immortality. That man who was speaking and who just now on that clip and was talking about the emotional connection with subconscious, that is what prevents us from becoming immortal beings. Our attachment through our emotions to the material expressions of life, so that we are tied time after time after time, lifetime after lifetime, to those physical realities which occur and die and then reoccur and die again and reoccur and die again. That is not advancement. That's going round on a merry-go-round, round in circle, getting nowhere, except hopefully each time we learn something, so we're climbing a tiny, tiny step. What Christ is teaching you is how to go from the bottom of the ladder to the top of the ladder in one gigantic leap. And when you get to the top of that ladder, the whole of the universe is open to you. And unbelievable excitement and interesting things to go and see and do, endless experiences to have, far surpassing anything in the round that you go here, chasing a bigger house and a bigger car and a faster boat and the things that we tend to go after on this planet. So yep. Christ is talking about a whole different world.
But Jesus wasn't poor, right? He wasn't a beggar. The disciples that
wealthy.
He chose, the people he chose as his disciples, also were not
wealthy.
Poor men, right? They were well-educated.
No, absolutely not.
All right, let's talk about people he chose, the kind of people he decided that he wanted to follow him.
First of all, Christ's stepfather, Joseph, right, carpenter. And in those days, the master carpenter would be undoubtedly the wealthiest man in any community, except the Essenes, of course, were a sharing community. They held things in common, so that he would not be considered any richer or poorer than anybody else. However, we should remember that the Magi of the East brought three gifts to the Christ child when he was born: gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Myrrh being more valuable than diamonds in those days. It was the most valuable substance on the planet. Frankincense was next, and gold was next. So Christ's family, parents, had in their hands on his behalf enough to make him a wealthy man for life. Secondly, we know that when he chose his disciples, he chose Peter, right, the rock. Peter not only owned a boat, there are several records of him owning several boats. He was a ship owner, in other words. In that day and age, he was a mineonatus, right? And he lived in a house. It tells you, you know, he went back to his house. He didn't live in some little shack. He lived in a pretty substantial house with his family living in it. We also have Luke, who, if I remember correctly, was the physician, highly educated and undoubtedly wealthy man. Doctors are always rich in any age. And then you had Matthew was a tax collector. Again, he was at least an accountant and respected enough to be collecting taxes for Rome. So, and undoubtedly, as he was working for the Romans, but collecting taxes from his own people, he was, like all politicians and taxers in this day and age, including our IRS, creaming a large amount off the top for himself. So all his disciples were men of substance in that age. They were educated, wealthy men of substance. And so he was not trying to teach people who knew nothing. He was teaching people who were already savvy when it came to the world they lived in, successful at what they did, well established with their families. These were like in any community in England, you have the alderman, you know, the mayor of the town, or in any small town in America, you have the city council and the big people in the local community, and pretty much that's who Jesus' disciples were. Jesus was not going to surround himself with a bunch of idiots by any means. And there was nothing simple about Peter. No, they say, you know, simple fisherman. There's nothing simple whatsoever. He was an astute and successful businessman, very successful, with his own ships and his own just very successful men. And they were the ones that he was teaching, not just with the parables, because obviously they were standing around organizing all his groups that he was speaking to, marshaling them, keeping them in order. One of his disciples carried the purse for the community with the money in it and went ahead and booked accommodation for them. Like, you know, we would phone ahead and book a hotel room. Well, Christ sent one of his disciples ahead with the money to book reservations in the next town that he was going to be speaking in. This was not just some group of country yokels wandering around saying a few words when they felt like it. This was a well-run, well-organized campaign of speech-making up and down the whole of Palestine, especially Galilee and all the way south, giving the message to the people that could be spread abroad. And in the process, he was training the group of disciples who, by the way, had as many women as men. But by the time the churches came to organize themselves, they didn't allow women. So the women are written out, but the women were certainly there. And Mary Magdalene and Mary and Martha and his mother, the Madonna, almost certainly traveled with him and spoke on his behalf as often as he did, but telling the story that he was telling. And as you said, he told the people in general, he taught them by parables, just the way we teach children. You know, we read them things like Aesop's fables and the story about, you know, the bunny being chased by the fox and the bunny screams, oh, please don't throw me in the briar patch. Don't throw me in the briar patch. And when Mr. Bad Fox throws Bunny, he throws him right into the briar patch, which, of course, the rabbit really, really wanted him to do because he knows that inside the briar patch, the fox can't get him. So we use parables to this day, teaching our children. And that's what Christ was doing. He was taking all those people, the general public, if you like, and treating them like children, because he was telling them a new story, a new idea, a new way of thinking. And he was saying to them, I'm not saying the old stories are bad stories. I'm not saying the old stories are untrue stories, but you know those stories. And now I'm telling you a new story. And the new story is that you can do so much more than just simply get through your life obeying the old rules. That there are new rules, there are new doorways opening, and this is where you're going. And that's how he taught the people. his disciples, he took off in secret into some out-of-the-way place and taught them differently. He taught them the deeper message, the deeper understanding of the parables that he was teaching. Just like I might waste your time explaining the story of the rabbit and the briar patch. that would be wasting your time.
But he was
teaching the disciples a bigger story, a more advanced story. And that story today is what we are talking about. And it has been written in a book. And I've been talking about this book for over 2 years now. It's called Saving Jesus. And it's a book that essentially, I am certain,
is what Christ
taught his disciples.
All right. Take a break. Let me go back to the book that we talked about. The Dalai Lama has written it. Here's a comment.
There is also growing awareness of the importance of a healthy environment. In very many ways, the last half century or so has been one of progress and positive change. At the same time, despite tremendous advances in so many fields, there is still great suffering, and humanity continues to face enormous difficulties and problems. While in the more affluent parts of the world, people enjoy lifestyles of high consumption, there remain countless millions whose basic needs are not met. With the end of the Cold War, the threat of global nuclear destruction has receded, but many continue to endure the sufferings and tragedy of armed conflict. In many areas, too, people are having to deal with environmental problems, and with these, threats to their livelihood and worse. At the same time, many others are struggling to get by in the face of inequality, corruption, and injustice. These problems are not limited to the developing world. In the richer countries, too, there are many difficulties, including widespread social problems, alcoholism, drug abuse, domestic violence, family breakdown. People are worried about their children, about their education, and what the world holds in store for them. Now, too, we have to recognize the possibility that human activity is damaging our planet beyond a point of no return, a threat which creates further fear. And all the pressures of modern life bring with them stress, anxiety, depression, and increasingly, loneliness. As a result, everywhere I go, people are complaining. Even I find myself complaining from time to time. It is clear that something is seriously lacking in the way we humans are going about things. But what is it that we lack? The fundamental problem, I believe, is that at every level, we are giving too much attention to the external, material aspects of life while neglecting moral ethics and inner values.
And I think you said it best last time I talked with you about the secular answers, if you will.
So what are we to do? Where are we to turn for help? Science, for all the benefits it has brought to our external world, has not yet provided scientific grounding for the development of the foundations of personal integrity, the basic inner human values that we appreciate in others and would do well to promote in ourselves. Perhaps then we should seek inner values from religion, as people have done for millennia. Certainly religion has helped millions of people in the past, helps millions today, and will continue to help millions in the future. But for all its benefits in offering moral guidance and meaning in life, in today's secular world, religion alone is no longer adequate as a basis for ethics. One reason for this is that many people in the world no longer follow any particular religion. Another reason is that as the peoples of the world become ever more closely interconnected in an age of globalization and in multicultural societies, ethics based on any one religion would only appeal to some of us. It would not be meaningful for all. In the past, when peoples lived in relative isolation from one another, as we Tibetans lived quite happily for many centuries behind our wall of mountains, The fact that groups pursue their own religiously based approaches to ethics pose no difficulties. Today, however, any religion-based answer to the problem of our neglect of inner values can never be universal, and so will be inadequate. What we need today is an approach to ethics which makes no recourse to religion and can be equally acceptable to those with faith and those without, a secular ethics.
Okay, so how do you measure that those statements that he made in terms of where you're going?
Well, I would never presume to disagree with the Dalai Lama. That's for sure. And I don't disagree with what he's saying, except in one thing, and that is when he mentions about, you know, people needing religions. Most of the wars in the world throughout history, up until the most recent times, come about because of religion. Religion, I do not believe, helps anybody. I believe spirituality helps everybody. But spirituality is a whole different ballgame from religion. Religion is fun, the word, actually. It means something that stands between me and the Creator to interpret the Creator and his purpose for me. In other words, a priesthood of some kind, pastor, minister, vicar, priest, I don't care what you call them. It's putting somebody between you and God and allowing that man or that woman to tell you what you should be doing with your soul. And the vast majority of religions, and remember, the Dalai Lama is a Buddhist, and Buddhism is not a religion. It's a philosophy. And I'm 100% in favor of the philosophy of Buddhism. It's also the foundation of all the teachings of Christ and all the foundation of all the great teachers. So Buddhism is not a religion, right? Having set that aside, I would say this, that the religions generally require you to believe a package of beliefs which they, their community, their group has decided is the truth and the only truth that you can ever discover if you want to save your soul and prevent you from going to hell and damnation. And that is simply not right. It's not true, it's not correct, and it's not right by any standard of reasonable thinking. There is nobody out there ever has the right to tell you that your soul is going to hell and damnation. What the end result of your actions is determined by much higher authority than any man standing in front of any religion and preaching at you. So religions, I think, are something that we can well do without. However, a worldwide philosophy like Buddhism, which teaches the seven steps, pillars of wisdom, and the process of self-management, self-discipline, self-responsibility. That's what Buddhism teaches, right? This is what you've heard me talk about, and I don't know all that much about Buddhism, only what Spirit has told me about it. And I was amazed to find that what they were teaching to me was actually the same thing that is taught in the Buddhist belief structure, that this is about self-discipline and self-respect. And you don't need a religion for that. You need yourself and your Creator. You need Spirit.
Okay, I think I'm going to try to tap into this other program that we were supposed to be doing at 6:45. It's about that time. You may want to talk about, dial the number, the Baptist. What role did he play in terms of Jesus' life?
Right.
Oh, no, but not a big one.
Yes. No, I don't mind. I don't mind. I can only hang myself once. So.
Well,
on this show, I can hang myself 100 times, but that's okay.
Yeah, because this is, this is something we're doing. We're trying to tap into people who are open and interested in finding something different, finding something meaningful, finding ways to have a different life, if you will, because people need answers. You know, people were stumbling, if you will, in this country, in this world. And you know that. I don't have to repeat that over and over again. But let me see if I can dial this number and catch up with the people who said call in at 6:45. It is now 6:45.
Welcome to Grown Folk Talking. Express yourself. The podcast will begin momentarily.
So he,
please announce yourself.
Right, all right. Let me ask you a question real quick. The gentleman that's the governor of Georgia right now, when he ran against Stacey Abrams the first time, last time, wasn't he the secretary of, I think Secretary of State? He's the one that was supposed to be in charge of the elections. Wasn't that the case? I think so.
That's for Michelle.
Yeah, I think before he became governor, he held a position where he was the secretary or something, where he was in charge of the elections, the Board of Elections or something like that.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. And so that's why a lot of people think he cheated. Because he was in charge of counting votes. Now, how are they going to let him run against her as governor, and then he's the one counting the votes? You know, that's ridiculous.
Not only that, he the one had them communities shut down them voting booths down there.
Yeah, because he was in charge of that.
Michelle is our guest. Now, she's going to answer one question at a time. Michelle, go right ahead, because I got to check to see if our second guest came in for the evening. Go ahead, Michelle.
Yeah, we're here. Hello, can you hear me?
Okay, Brother Russ. Okay, brother, give me 1 second. About to end the first segment. Michelle, are you still here, Michelle?
I'm here.
Okay, you want to answer Dr. James' question? Then after that, sister, I'm gonna give you a little send-off. I want you to listen to the rest of the show. Go ahead. You want Dr. James to ask you a question. Go ahead, Sister Michelle.
What was your question, Dr. James?
I think they answered it. I said the guy that she ran against last time, that's the governor now, before he became governor, he was in charge. He was secretary or something in charge of elections or something, right? But he was in charge of them counting the votes.
Right. That's correct. That was a big issue in the last election because a lot of people felt like he cheated or did something that caused the election to be off.
There you go. That's all I had to say. That's all I did. But yeah, he cheated.
Thank you, Doc. Of course. That's what they do. All right. So listen, hey, Michelle, I want you to kick back now and crack that bag of organic popcorn because we're going to take you on a ride for this next one. We got Brother Russell. But once again, hey, family. This is my newfound friend, Sister Michelle. She's going to keep me posting on what's going on down there in Atlanta, all right? And I know she ain't no chump. She's going to keep fighting the fight. And like Malcolm said back in the day when he was interviewed by a reporter, he said, Malcolm, what is the price of freedom? And Malcolm answered with no problem. He said, well, sir, the price of freedom is death. So if you're scared, you don't belong on my show. You don't belong on this network. We can't be scared, y'all. We got to fight the fight, like Leon said. We have to go into these neighborhoods, and I walk past them all the time. I'm right here in Newark. Everybody heard of Newark, New Jersey. Okay, but I talk to these young brothers. All right, it's how you carry yourself around them. All right, and I'm gonna tell you right now. When I was 19, I used to box. That's why I stay in shape at 65 because I can still deal with these young boys. All right. Physically, and listen, I'm not no Johnny, you know what my uncle used to say. I ain't no Johnny Badass, but the bottom line is you have to know how to lingo. And Leon, I'm sure Leon will back me up on this. I know how to talk to these brothers because I know their language in the street. And like the dear lady that played, what was her name, on Good Times, Thelma. They did a documentary on that. I took from Thelma because I cherry-picked sayings from everyone that has a good saying. She said, my parents, when we were raised up in the projects in Brooklyn, she said, never let what's around you get in you. That's that negative vibe, as Sister Marva would say, and Brother Leon would say. And I'm sure we all would say we agree. So with that being said, family, Michelle is going to be back up here again. because she's a deputy with Grown Folks Talk and Express Yourself Podcast Network. Michelle, now you can put the phone on mute if you like, sis. Kick back and tell Naya I will be giving her a call to see what happened to her. I'm going to bring her back at a later time. By the way, before we bring on...
I'm here. I'm still here.
Okay.
I'm still here.
Okay. We're going to bring on Russ in 1 second. Naya, are you listening? I'm just trying to give her the benefit of the doubt. All right, she got a little tied up. Okay, well, we'll get back with the sister. But anyway, family, without further ado, this is the second part of the show. I listened to this brother on my man Nate's channel, along with the sister that works with him. And Russ, no disrespect, I don't want to mispronunciate the sister's name. Okay,
Gillian.
You have her, and you have it with you. Gillian, there you go, family.
Gillian Breed.
It's right on my Facebook. Okay, family, so you got the name. So without further ado, I told this brother when he comes on. Go ahead, brother.
No, I was saying if you want to see, she's written a couple of books dealing with the spirit in your soul and how to become a better person and improve yourself so that when you do go for an improvement, ascension is called, you moving from this, from the third degree to fourth or fifth or sixth or seventh. But she will talk about that. So she's been around. She's in clairvoyant. She's been teaching a long time. I have a book in my hand called The Violent Flame of Meditation for people who want to learn how to meditate. She's been teaching metaphysics for more than 30 years. And she has a website. If you go to nohoax.net, it's not her website, but her husband who crossed over, nohoax.net. There are a lot of books and a lot of information on that website. Now, what we are talking about is the fact that the United States government has recently said that they think that we have some aliens, some other species from other parts of the universe on the planet with us, right? All of a sudden. But for many years, for the last 40, 50, 60, 70 years or more, they have denied the fact that anybody who looks like an alien, who is an alien, or that either the vastness of the multiplicity of the universe, the millions and millions and billions and trillions of planets, that we are the only persons in the vastness of the universe, which is not true. And I want Gillian to talk about that. Gillian, are you with us?
Hello, Russell. Yes.
All right. Thank you very
Good
much
evening.
For being with us. And so why don't we talk about who you are, where you came from, how long you've been on the planet, how many times you've been to the planet, incarnated to the planet, and those kind of issues. And who we are as a species, the human beings, who are we,
okay,
and how did we get to where we are today? Please.
Okay, right. How many days have we got? it's a very, very, very long story. And I think I'll cut it short just by saying, Nashumzu Gillian, and that's saying in the Anunnaki language, my name is Gillian or Gillian. It's been a name I've had for very many thousands and thousands of years. And I claim it in this lifetime as my own. It is my own. So my name's Gillian. I live in Montana right now. I came from Yorkshire in England. The odd thing about me that makes me maybe a little bit different to most people is that I have continuing consciousness. I've never lost consciousness from lifetime to lifetime for many, many tens of thousands of years. And I remember some pretty ancient history way back in Atlantis, when my name then was Atalanta, and through the ages since, to the time I returned to this planet about 14,500 years ago, about 4,000 years ago, was destroyed in what is now known as Peru, and have since, during the last 4,000 years, done multiple reincarnations as a normal Earth human on this planet, but never losing consciousness of who I was, where I came from, and what I was. Otherwise, I'm just like everybody else. And I certainly, as a clairvoyant, have those gifts, have always had those gifts. But they're available to anybody and everybody. It's just a matter of frequency. What I'd like to talk about, more importantly, is who we are as humans. About 400,000 years ago, experimentation was started on this planet with many of the animals existing, because a race of beings that we currently call the Anunnaki or the Anuna, which simply means they came from the skies, they came down to Earth. These beings were here on this planet at that time collecting gold. Their original intention had been to take it out of the oceans. This proved to be impractical, so they were digging it out of mines, predominantly in Africa, and they were using their own people to dig for the gold. And after several hundred thousands of years, they got fed up with doing it, and they told their scientists, find some other means of getting this gold out, because basically we're going on strike. It was the astronauts, so the Air Force, their Air Force, that was made to do the digging. And they said, basically, we're going on strike. We're not going to dig anymore. So you find some better way to do this. So the scientists began trying to domesticate and train various animal species in much the same way, you know, that we trained horses to ride or to pull carts. They tried to domesticate animals and train them to get the gold. It didn't work. They did lots of experiments trying to do genetic alterations. Didn't work. So eventually, against all the fundamental rules of the universe, which is basically non-interference with a developing intelligent species, you are not allowed to do it in this universe. But they went ahead and did it anyway. They took the ova out of a woman out of East Africa and impregnated that ova with their own sperm. And then they did the genetic engineering. And in the process, they removed four genes from the human DNA and they implanted two of their own genes in replacement. And so began the journey of Homo sapiens, which is us, which is what we are. And it took That began about 40,000 years ago, and it took them right the way up to about 6,000 years ago, by which time they had perfected and educated man and developed a whole civilization which came to be known to us as the Sumerian, the pre-flood Sumerian civilization, and then after Noah's flood civilization. And about 6,000 years ago, roughly, the Anuna left the planet. They packed up and left, and they handed over self-rulership of this planet to the humans that they had genetically altered. And by that time, that gene, that Homo sapien gene, was spread all across the planet. It was everywhere that there were people who had previously, 400,000 years ago, been like Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal. They had spread the genes, and now you had a planet which was peopled by the Neanderthals had pretty well died out, a few Cro-Magnons, and these new Homo sapiens, which were spreading everywhere and were in charge of their own planet. So for 6,000 years, we ourselves have had charge of this planet. And unfortunately, we've pretty well destroyed it. We've done a lot of damage to the planet. And now we are arriving at the point where we need to think about correcting it. The other thing that's happened parallel to that is that as soon as the Anuna left, other less desirable extraterrestrials, particularly the reptilian species from the planetary system Draco, entered into relationships with governments across this planet. Now, the early governments were mostly ruled by a priesthood. The leaders were also the priesthood of the, and it was through these religious organizations that were establishing across the planet that the extraterrestrials, particularly the reptilians, made inroads by offering technology. And this has continued up to this present time, where in the present day and age, we have a huge number, unfortunately, of reptilians in a powerful relationship with the remains of the Germans and the Nazi Party from World War II, who are working under Antarctica and have been doing since the end of World War II, developing high technologies, which our government, through the Pentagon, interacts with and receives technology from. So there are two things that we know about, and there are also a high influence from a group from the Pleiades, the Pleiadians, who are also well documented to have bases under the Antarctic. And currently these documentations that prove the evidence of these people and what they are doing with the governments of the world, this through these open disclosures, which are now available through groups of researchers, authors and so on, people like Dr. Michael Sala, who has written extensively about this with very good documentation and photocopies of documents of presidents and so on and so forth. This information is coming out into the general. It's an ancient relationship with extraterrestrials, where the extraterrestrials sell technology in exchange for the right to abduct humans off this planet. So not only have we allowed destructive things to go on our planet unwittingly, we haven't done it intentionally, we've done it unwittingly, but it's finally catching up with us with the destruction of our environment. We have also, through the power that we have given to elected or so-called elected governments throughout the ages, again, not a new thing, it's gone on throughout the last 6,000 years, it's just got a lot worse in the last 100 years. We have put power into the hands of a very few people who work behind the scenes to manipulate what we believe are our freely elected governments, which are not in any case, in any situation, truly freely elected. We have given them power, and that power works in conjunction with these extraterrestrials, and essentially we've given away our freedom to that powerful group that now controls us and allows, stands by and allows the abduction of tens of thousands of humans off the planet every year, for example, that are used in slave labor camps, not just on this planet, but in other locations in the universe as well, I understand. So pretty much what we've come to after 6,000 years, but the great beauty, the glass half full side of the picture is that humanity is waking up. It's waking up in a very rapid rate over the last 25 years. The wake-up call has really been going around. 25 years ago, we probably had less than 10% of the world's population willing to even give credence to these ideas. Now it's nearer 30 or 40% of people who are willing to at least be open to the idea of these things going on. And in the last 10 or 15 years, so much documentation, so many whistleblowers are coming out and telling the truth. Hopefully people will start believing them soon. And it really is a wake-up call now. Save ourselves from the extraterrestrial dominance and save our planet by getting rid of the evil cabal, which is basically making profit out of all of us every single time we breathe.
Okay. She said a lot of mouthful. For some people are lying. I guess all of it may be a disbelief, but it's a whole new world. And even though it's been covered up, now coming to light is going to be the truth of who we are as a people, the Homo sapiens, if you will, and the other entities that are not only on the Earth, but who live on the Moon, who live on Mars and other parts of the galaxy, even live in cabins under the Earth right here on this planet. But here is some, and then I'll turn it back to you if you have any questions. But we wanted to kind of just, you know, touch a little bit about what's going on and what's being discussed in many high circles on this planet.
answer yet to the question, are we alone in the universe?
Wow. New York Times is out this morning with new details about an upcoming and long-awaited report from the U.S. government looking into recent UFO sightings. Here's ABC's Andrew Dimbert.
This morning, new insight into what the U.S. government might know about UFOs.
My gosh.
U.S. intelligence agencies will present a report to Congress by the end of the month on UFO sightings by members of the military. And according to the New York Times, that report will say the vast majority of documented incidents did not originate from the U.S. military, and the UFOs are not a result of secret government technology, showing encounters that fighter pilots had in recent years. One video is from 2004 when Commander David Fravor says he and his team tracked a tic-tac-shaped object over the Pacific Ocean.
So I go like this, and it's climbing still. And when it gets right in front of me, it just disappears.
Disappears?
Disappears. Like gone. We have nothing that goes that fast and just starts climbing at will.
Just seconds later, the USS Princeton picked up the object on radar 60 miles away. Skeptics claim the unidentified sightings could be some sort of advanced drones developed by Russia or China. Others say the videos are just cameras playing tricks on us.
Alex Dietrich said that she drew a diagram back in the day, but where is that diagram now? So there were contemporary accounts, and they've kind of like just vanished, and now we're just left with these stories that they tell, these recountings of what they kind of remember happening.
But even former President Obama recently said something unexplained is out there.
But what is true, and I'm actually being serious here, is that there's footage and records of objects in the skies that we don't know exactly what they are.
Well,
according to the New York Times, the UFO report, which is due in Congress by June 25th, will present few conclusions.
Now, I know for some people that you're in shock by now, but it's all got to come to the fore. It's been hidden for many years, especially since Roswell of 1947. The government has been denying, and hiding all the truth from us that we have other people, other entities from different parts of the universe here on the planet. Now, Barack said he can't say too much because they deny him even. Now, he has been to Antarctica. He has seen what's the underground bases that she was referring to with the Nazis, the Nazi regime and the slave population there, and all the, all the spaceships that are there that are used not only by the government but used by other forces. And here's another report.
On flying saucers, do you yourself believe that they exist?
Well, I'm positive they exist. The weight of the evidence makes it impossible to arrive at any other conclusion.
It started way back in 1947. There were UFO fleets that were being seen above the skies of Washington. People were scared.
Tonight, we go after a fantastic story. The story that flying saucers from other worlds are visiting our planet.
The truth coincides with the expansion of mass media in a way where we're suddenly receiving our information about the world through the television, through the radio.
One thing is clear. You could not keep a spaceship a secret. Too many journalists could not be restrained from trumpeting one of the greatest news stories of all time.
And so whatever authority the mainstream that has long denied the existence of these beings had slowly began to slip away. Eventually, that authority breaks down completely with the internet.
I got it.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh.
What the hell?
I think that we are, as a people, willing to believe almost anything. Conspiracy theories or myth can take hold using the possibility of UFOs existing as a way of doubting almost everything in our culture.
Now, for many people who are listening right now, you probably say it's very, very disconcertingly, I don't believe it. It can't happen. No way. All I understand is that we're on this planet, we have some Asians, we have some blacks, we have some whites, we have some people from, you know, the South Americans, some Spanish, and that's it. No, it goes way beyond that, and it's going to be slow, gradually, that you will understand that we are not alone in this universe.
And lots of people, a lot of very, you know, intelligent and successful people believe and see UFOs. Researchers in contact with some of the people still today decide to look at the effects. What if thousands of people saw it? You know, what kind of effects would they have? What would that do to our culture?
Since the first UFO was sighted, there has been no evidence that unidentified flying objects are a threat to our national security.
Project Blue Book, which lasted all the way through 1969, was not to investigate anything. It was rather to explain it. To say, look, you guys think you don't understand this, but we do. We're the all-powerful government. We're the all-powerful CIA. We can explain this.
Some of the explanations they gave were so ludicrous that it was essentially like ridicule.
I cannot prove in a court of law that marsh gas is the full explanation of these sightings.
So it was about 2 months later.
Chicago Tribune interviewing several people anonymously, including maintenance workers, baggage handlers, and pilots, who each and all described a dark gray saucer-like object that hovered low over concourse before shooting off into the sky.
Most UFO sightings are fairly quick. Something flies by, right? This was at least 5 minutes in the middle of the afternoon rush hour in the daylight. Pilots on the ground in their planes who were just taxiing in or out were looking, leaning out, looking at it. There was a lot of radio chatter about it.
We got traffic here about 1:30 or 2 o'clock. It's very bright, doesn't seem to be moving.
Really not one witness to this event would put their name on the record. Not one.
The FAA is still pinning this to some kind of weather phenomenon, that some lights from the airport and the overcast skies somehow got together and created this image. But weather experts, astronomy experts, others that I've talked to said that that's bunk.
Somebody has an obligation within the government. If it's not the FAA, it's got to be someone else to deal with that, to protect the aircraft that are around it, to find out what it is.
It seems to me that the likeliest conclusion here is that the aliens have landed many years ago in this country, in this world, with one goal in mind, to create conspiracy theories and then just sit back and enjoy them.
Well, yeah, he was being a little facetious there.
Yeah.
But
yes,
that's okay. Julie, you might go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead. Please.
I think there's one thing I would like to point out. The vast majority of the flying saucer type craft that we see are not spaceships. They are ships that come off this planet, go up and come back down again to this planet. They belong to the Pleiadians, they belong to the Germans under Antarctica, they belong out of the secret city in Siberia, which dismantled a lot of its workings with nuclear some years ago. They're all over the planet. They have been coming out of places underground, undersea. Lake Titicaca is a famous place. There is an underground base there, the underwater base there, where ships are frequently seen coming up and down. So the vast majority, I want to say at least 80% of those flying saucer type sightings come from bases that exist in connection with extraterrestrials on this planet, right? And they would never go into space. They're not space capable. They might be capable of operating within the solar system, but they are not capable of going out into deep space, and most of them couldn't even go into the solar system. The other small round ones that you see coming up and down the saucer types may be landing craft coming from a bigger ship that is doing some kind of study where it sends down a group of explorers, if you like, or scientists of their own from a different species, and they come down and they do what they do and they go again, and they also use the small round magnetically driven ships that depend on, they use gravitar things So I don't understand all the technology, but it's not the kind of technology you go through space with. I do know that, right? So most of what you see now, the big triangular craft, they are out of what used to be Area 51. And when that person, whoever it was, said, you know, the government doesn't know about this, and it's not our secret technology, well, whoever that spokesman was, I'm inclined to agree, because the only people who knew what was going on for a long, long time until very recently when the whistleblowers started going out, I'm talking about the last 15 or 20 years, up till that time, the vast majority of people in government knew nothing about this. The Congress knows nothing about this. And the president, generally speaking, knows nothing about this. There are letters of request signed by Ronald Reagan, signed by John Kennedy, and sent to the CIA, because the CIA had a very small group within the CIA, a secret CIA group in the CIA, who were the only ones for years and years and years, so I want to say since the industrial age began, they were the only ones who knew exactly what the connection was and what was going on with the extraterrestrials and where they were located on the planet. And in other words, the whole story. In addition to that, you have a few generals in our army, not the Navy, but the army, who are working with the extraterrestrial, with the reptilians and the Germans under Antarctica. And they are only a handful, and they know what's going on. And it is from that grouping that most of the whistleblowers have come out. And Dr. Michael Sala, who wrote the book History of the Antarctic, has in his, it's a three-book trilogy that he wrote, and in there, he has photocopies of these letters that I'm referring to and other documentation, which does spell out the history of what was going on. And then, of course, there's William Tompkins, who wrote about his whole experience with extraterrestrials throughout his lifetime. And he died, and he was in his 90s, I think, when he died a couple of years ago. And from the time he was a teenager, he was involved with the extraterrestrials and their involvement in Martin Lockheed, which has now passed on to Boeing. So Martin Lockheed was one of the early ones that had a research and development group that was working constantly with the extraterrestrials in the development of technology. So for the government to say they didn't know, strictly speaking, most of them didn't. But on a more truthful level, some of them always did.
Okay. Maybe we need to take a break on this. People ask any questions they may have. I have a website called projectdisclosure.com, and I will be talking about the subject matter from now on. I just recently put it up. And some of these broadcasts that you might want to go listen to, projectdisclosure.com. Now, let's talk about William Tompkins. He just passed at 94, but he was contacted back in 1940, 41, 42, and he worked secretly with all those big corporations up until now, never disclosing this information to anyone, not even his family members. So it's been it's the biggest secret that they've been holding close to their chest for more than 100 years or more, I can't say 100 years, especially since 1940. And before he died, and I'll turn it back over to the host of the program if you want, but this is what he said.
People all over this planet for at least 6,000 years have been influenced by extraterrestrials, the Dracos and the reptilians. They have taken the information that is in essentially every school on the planet, and they've modified the information. all history documentation in this country and on every country on the planet have been given lies about astronomy, lies about mathematics, lies about technical capabilities, lies about the universe, you name it, okay? Everything have been lies. Every PhD on this planet, whether they're scientific, whether they're medical, makes no difference. Every book that they read the 6 years they were in the university are lies. They're not telling the truth. They were not taught the truth. At that time, we had 34 admirals in the Navy. All of them had been through Annapolis. They learned how to learn everything about the Navy, everything about history, everything about mathematics, everything about astronomy, you name it. They learned all lies. So who did the Secretary of Navy Forrestal select for this job? Turns out Admiral Riccobata was not an American. He was born in Australia. The Secretary of the Navy selected an Australian man who had not been infected with the lies that the reptilians had taught us. He was freer of that. So the Secretary of the Navy was aware of this because he had been contacted by Nordic extraterrestrials, people here trying to help the United States. Okay? Very important point. So when I was selected, I hadn't been to the universities. I hadn't gotten the bad information. I hadn't been given the wrong information. And this is the reason I was selected, because I was knowledgeable of the Navy. I was knowledgeable what the threats were. But I hadn't gone to the university and picked up all the lies.
Yeah, he'd been holding those secrets for more than 70 years as he worked with a group of extraterrestrials in the science of building spaceships and science of building ships, you know, that float and for the Navy. So all I'm saying is that this is a beginning, just the tip of the iceberg of all the lies that have been told and all the secrets that they have with the young lady would say the cabal, I would say with Majestic 12 that Harry Truman set up, the secret group that have been in control of all this information of billions and trillions of dollars spent in terms of operating not only in Antarctica, but operating across the four corners of the world. Now, let me just close it for because I don't want to go on and on. I could go on for hours. But if you look at his book, Selected by Extraterrestrials, I would get that book by William Mills Tompkins. I would get that book. The other book that she had mentioned by Michael Sala, and he has a book. Go to Amazon and get it. Antarctica's Hidden Story, where they talked about Project Paperclip, if you will, Operation Paperclip, they called it after World War II, 1942, 1945, where all the Germans came to the United States and took over all the big industries, especially NASA with Von Braun and all that. But now many of them, as she will tell you, are now in Antarctica. Why don't we tell them a little bit about Antarctica, and then we can open the lines for people who are still listening to us, most of whom have tremendous disbelief in anything we have said for the last half hour. But that's just the way it is with new information of this nature. So why don't you talk about Antarctica just a bit?
Can we take a break before we do that?
So people have a chance
to talk in, because y'all have given
a lot of information.
For those of us that's not of the conscious community that doesn't study.
Sure, I understand. And I can appreciate it.
They should be assessing. I'm going to say this. I'm going to let Sister Marva chime in because she's the female, and the female should go first. And because I know her seat over there is on fire right now.
Yes.
Because my seat is on fire right now to chime in, to speak in trumpet.
Leon, let me say this, all right? That's part of my panel, Brother Russ and Sister Green. I just want to ask one question, and we're going to do Marvin and Leon and Miss Adrian. All right, Miss Adrian, I hope you're not on the time constraint because I heard you ask Lexa what time it was. But anyway, let me say this, family. I want to ask Sister Green a question, or either Russ. Now, I remember we were talking about missing people, all right?
Yeah.
And the laboratories where the missing people were being experimented on by the Germans. Question, a lot of those guys back in during the Hitler tyranny time that were scientists, all right, unless I'm missing something here, they're still living. But obviously they had to set up like the World Economic Forum where Klaus Schwab and Dr. Harari, who consider us worthless and useless, they had to set up some type of class to train scientists to conduct the work that their predecessors were experimenting on with the Jews historically, because I just want to say this and let it go. There's a gentleman by the name of John Monroe. He's our holistic eye care practitioner up here. He said his father worked with the United States Army, and they went over there to Germany, and they knocked down where the Jews were being imprisoned at the time, and it was the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And what happened was they freed the Jews. Now, this is the story that John Monroe told me. But what happened was his father came back and told him that the German scientists had these things. It's on YouTube. It's called Nazi Bell. I didn't get a chance to look at it yet. But if you Google Nazi Bell, they said that the American soldiers were privy to seeing these spaceships that Sister Green was talking about, and that the German scientists had. Well, I said, well, John, if you saw them, what did your father say? How did they stay? He said they were on three or four legs or something of that nature. But he said they were working, and the German scientists were privy to this information. So I'm going to leave it like that. With these people, if they're still experimenting on them, are these the predecessors to their grandfathers and their fathers?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Julian, answer that for him.
Oh, okay. Yes.
The Nazis in Antarctica.
Yeah. That's going on in Antarctica. And in underground bases. Delphi is one of the underground bases where that is well known to our government here in the United States and is also used for that kind of ongoing experimentation. And this I personally know is true, right? That continues. I will tell you something which is even more far-fetched, harder to believe, which I can't prove, certainly, but there is a lot of evidence out there now from these whistleblowers who have experienced this and are claiming the truth of it. And that is that we're not only dealing with the appointed descendants and authorized people from the end of World War II, but that many of those Nazis, including many of their top scientists, who were taken down into Antarctica before the end of the war, Hitler moved much of his heavy industry and thousands of slave laborers and his top scientists to Antarctica before World War II ended. He used the last 2 years of the war to do this, according to newly released documents. And one of the groups of people that they work with, and this is why I'm highly suspicious of them, are the Pleiadians. The Pleiadians have a technology which alters the telomeres in the brain and allows you to, as it were, gain extra time. They call it going back in time. They can actually do this. Now, how I know that they can do it is, and of course this means that some of the people who were actually Nazis in World War II are still alive and living because they extend their lives exponentially. And I know that this technology exists, and I know it's true. And the reason I know it is because my dear late husband, George Green, himself had experience with Billy Meyer over in Switzerland that many people have heard of. He was famous for his photography of UFOs right through the 70s and 80s. He came to world attention with his photographs. And my dear George went over there and met with him and actually was introduced to two of these so-called Pleiadians. They presented themselves as Pleiadians. They arrived on a spaceship, one of the round ones. They landed on the property. They introduced themselves as Semyasi and Quetzal to my husband George. And they also allowed him to use what they call a ray weapon, which will shoot straight through a tree. And then when they'd done it, they moved the tree into a different timeline. They said, don't worry, we haven't destroyed the tree. We simply moved it. So they moved it out of the timeline, and then later they moved it back again. So I know they have this kind of technology available to them, because my own husband experienced it and photographed it, and I have the photographs. So this is some of the things they can really do, and it's absolutely mind-boggling. And this is why I am concerned about the Pleiadians, or sometimes known as the Nordic people. And my question is, what is their agenda? What do they want? We know the reptilians are working with the Germans and producing high technological weapons for the government and other governments as well. We know that. But what we're not sure of is the Pleiadian involvement, because they claim that although they are under the Antarctic, working in a different area of that continent from the Germans, they are now the white hats and they only want good things. But they are the same people who gave that technology to the Germans through an organization called the Vril Society before World War II, and it allowed the Germans to build all the V rockets that they did all their bombing with in World War II, and it allowed them to develop the Bell craft that you just mentioned and that is well documented with the original plans and designs in Dr. Sala's books about Antarctica, and which Mr. Tompkins actually was involved in the development and design of for Martin Lockheed, and now that technology is with Boeing. So it all this ties together. All these people cannot be lying. Somebody in there is bringing out the truth, and we need to open our eyes and really be open to it.
Well, let me.
Brother Russ. Thank you, Sister Green, for that. I appreciate it, because we got another person who wants to ask a question. Sister Marble, go ahead, Russ. You want to say something real quick?
Oh, yeah. One minute. That's all. 60 seconds. Maybe 62 seconds. Mm-hmm. Listen, you got to start doing homework. You can go to the Disclosure Project by Dr. Stephen Greer. He's been researching this for at least 40 years, and he's very accomplished. And here's what he has to say in 1 minute. Listen.
So I'm retired from emergency medicine now. I'm not in the ER. I'm working now to try to bring this information and, more equally importantly, the technologies that are behind these spacecraft and things that are being reported on CNN now, because what the public isn't being told is that we have in fact figured out how those objects operate, and that would give us an entirely new and advanced civilization where we would not need fossil fuels, oil or gas or coal or nuclear power. So it's a very big story. Most people think the secrecy around this is because the government has just been incompetent. That's not true. That narrative is a false narrative. The true narrative is that I will quote from a top secret memo released during the past few decades, but it was dated 1951, and it stated that the subject was the most classified matter in the U.S. government, exceeding the classification of the development of the hydrogen bomb, I'm quoting. So that document, by the way, is up on our website, SiriusDisclosure.com, S-I-R-I-U-S Disclosure.com.
Yeah, he has a lot of information. He's been doing research on this, trust me, for 40 years. He moved away from being in charge of the hospital emergency or ER center. He put it aside, and he's been out on a stump chasing all of this down. I mean, it's just mind-boggling when you do, when you read the books and you start Googling all of this stuff and you go through the 1-2-3s, you'll see that. And one other piece that, go ahead. No, I think you had a question.
Okay. Hold up. Sister Marva, go right ahead, sister. I can
come on now?
Yes, ma'am. Go right ahead.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I want to thank the sister and I want to thank the brother. The information was very informative. It's an honor to, you know, really sit and listen. And I am not a scholar. I have intuition. I've studied metaphysics, but not on any university levels. And I do a lot of research, and I'm also very intuitive, and I've been searching for the truth, I would say, since 1989 when somebody told me, hey, you're on the path. And I said, what's the path? You're seeking enlightenment. And I said, really?
Yeah.
But anyhow, what the sister was saying, the history that she put forth, it parallels the brother that's out there, Ismael Perez. And I just want to read the back of his book, and he put this book out in 2021. Let me get this light here. It says, in this new and exciting book, you will find the true history of Earth as it connects to the suppressed history of our galaxy in a way where science, philosophy, and spirituality finally come together as one. You'll come to understand that the true origin of our species, our cosmic ancestry as it relates to endless worlds, other dimensions, and multiple universes. I will open up your eyes about Earth's place in the multiverse and about a greater organization of cosmos that is being orchestrated by the multi-councils that exist on every level from the central universe to the local planetary systems. Most importantly, you will have a better understanding of our reality in terms of evidence that is currently being suppressed by a controlled academia and the scientific consensus. And that's just, you know, the back of his book. And it's called Our Cosmic Origin. By
right.
Ismael Perez, and you can get it on.
Right.
Yeah, you can. Okay, you familiar with it?
The concept,
yeah, and
of
you can get it. Say it again.
The concept that he's talking about. He's right. He's right on target with 2,000%.
Yeah, no, yeah. I was just wondering if you were familiar with his book.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to say a few other things. Nisara Gassara. Now that's the National Economic Recovery Act. Okay, it's connected with the military, and it's also connected with, I guess, the secret interplanetary whatevers that are helping to change what's going on here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go on the Sarah Gassara Network on YouTube, they're giving updates, you know, so that people aren't, you know, scared to death and know that, you know, that things are, that, you know, what has happened on the planet is being taken care of on an interplanetary level or higher spiritual levels, because the mother of it all, our source, which is feminine, has decided that, you know, this can no longer go on because the human race has been seeded with basically all the superior genes of all the known universes. And we're here asleep with, you know, with these, you know, with the superior things because our DNA has been shut down. We only use 4% of what
true.
We have.
Or less, yeah.
And
true.
From what I know, once a certain amount of the population, and this is world population, black, blue, green, red, white, you know, all the colors, once a certain percentage of the population reaches critical mass, and I don't know that number, we'll move from this third dimensional density and what you call this hypnosis that we're under into the fourth dimension and some even into the fifth dimension.
Right.
And right now, there are, you know, people that, you know, are here that, you know, they have, you know, special, they can do special things, you know, clairvoyant, clairaudient, and some of them are telepathic, that are working together to make this happen because the majority of, you know, of the world is still asleep. And from what I know, they have a place called Raven Rock. And I don't want to identify the location of the place, but Raven Rock is where the different leaders are secluded. And they're putting together the new systems that are going to be implemented in the world. And all of the riches and wealth and stuff that have been pillaged from the people of the world have been confiscated back from the Pope, confiscated back from the Queen of England. And it goes way beyond trillions of dollars. It's zazillions, jazillions. And they're saying that, you know, when this wealth is redistributed, once you know, once we move out of this density that we're in, that this wealth is going to be distributed, basically each and every one of the citizens on planet Earth will become at least millionaires, if not billionaires,
well,
because your Social Security, your birth certificate, your planetary citizenship have all been used as means of cash resources. You know, your human resource has been used to make money for just a few people. And as far as I know, you know, these things are being confiscated and frozen and set aside in trust.
Okay, Jillian, maybe Jillian, answer that. She's been here for the last 40,000 years in and out of incarnation. So could you address that issue, please, for us?
Well, first of all, I was very interested in all the things that you were saying, right up to the point, and certainly that Perez you mentioned, I've forgotten his other name. He was new to me until very recently, and then somebody suggested him to me, and I listened to one of his broadcasts, and I found him very interesting, and totally I couldn't disagree with anything he said, right? But I haven't read his book yet, and at some point I will get round to reading it. I was with you all the way until you mentioned Nasara, and I don't know why, but every time I have tried to find out about that, even just going to the website, something happened. You know, the internet went down. My computer went weird. I've been prevented from getting really, really getting to know about that. And except I understand the principle of it. And the principle is what you're talking about.
All right.
Involved. I think this is what you just said. influencing.
But I'm trying to tell you that the reason you're being cut off is artificial intelligence is overlaid over the extraterrestrials, and
I don't agree with that.
So you don't have to agree with me. You don't have to agree with me.
Could you let Jillian talk?
I'm telling you why I don't agree.
Marva, that's our guest. Let her finish, and she'll give you. We'll have time for the rebuttal. Go ahead. Go right ahead, Sister Green.
I'm just saying that I don't agree. I understand about artificial intelligence and everything that's going on with it, and it's the next nightmare that humans are going to have to deal with. And I can assure you, I have never lost connection with spirit and my extraterrestrial friends. So and I'm not asking you to believe anything I say, and I never ask people to believe what I say. But so far as I'm just telling you about myself now, right? As far as my concerns are and the things that I speak about, I recognize the issues of poverty, wealth, unfairness, discrimination, all those things that are a huge trial on this planet today. And I also go along entirely with what the Dalai Lama says about needing to reorganize this. Stay away from all those things which involve money, whether it's the Nasara program, whether it's, I denounce the WEF totally. That man who runs that, the Schwab man, he's a bad news. He's a manifestation of evil on this planet. So my only thought in listening to you is that I don't see, and I never have seen, the connection between the money itself, however, and I'm sure you're aware that actually the international community has no real description of money. It doesn't exist. There is no definition of money in the world banking system, and I'm sure you're well aware of that. So when they promise these things about redistribution of wealth and so on, in any capitalist or democratic system, that is simply not practical, and history has shown that it never works. There is actually a living example of that, and that's the state of Kuwait, which actually has total redistribution of wealth, in that every citizen in Kuwait receives an income on which they can live comfortably from the oil revenues. Every citizen, every one who lives in Kuwait, and they have had for the last 50 or 60 years, right? And that experiment fails because they still have rich and they still have poor in Kuwait. So that distribution of wealth that many, many people talk about in practical terms doesn't work out the way people think it will. But that's never been my concern. And so it would not be something that I would ever either agree with or disagree with, simply because it's not my worldview. My only concern for humanity is what they're doing with their souls. It's a concern of the potential opportunity for immortality, which is facing us in this immediate future, 1, 2, 3 years down the line, when the cosmic alignments literally complete themselves in our universe, and these energy waves which are rolling into the planet as we speak and have been doing for the last decade or so, when that completes itself at the end of 225, and the opportunity is there for us to move into the new experience of life, into the new frequencies, if we're ready to move forward, that has absolutely nothing to do with money or wealth or the WEF. All that will go away and be destroyed completely, because that is not a consideration in any of the higher frequencies. That's all I'm trying to say. I'm not disagreeing with you about anything, my dear. Not at all. I'm just trying to say that it's not what I'm talking about when I'm speaking. It's a different thing altogether. And I recognize your skills as an intuitive, and I highly respect that. And I have to say to you that, like you, I have never been to university. I have no real qualifications in the world. Any information I've had and everything I've ever taught has only been taught to me from spirit, by spirit, and sometimes through my extraterrestrial friends, sometimes directly from spirit. That's the only place I ever get my information. That's where I'm getting it from right now. When I speak of these things, I rely on spirit to show it to me. So I neither agree nor disagree with any of the things about Nisara, because as I said to begin with, I really know nothing about it. So that's part of your statement that I'm not qualified to address.
So you said that it blocked your communication. Every time you try to communicate or get information from Nisara Gasara, you're blocked. And the only thing that I said to you was that it's the AI that's probably, in most instances, doing that. But I'm in total agreement with what you say, and that we are moving in interdimensional as conscious people from one level. We're ascending from the third dimension into the fourth, and some of us will go from the fourth to the fifth. And yeah, there will be no need for money, because you can materialize what you need. You will no longer be living in survival. In third density, we mostly survive. We go to work to get paid, to buy food, to keep, to pay our bills, and so forth and so on. When we move to fourth density, then you have a reality where you don't have to go to work if you don't want to go to work. And you can design whatever you want. You're no longer living in a survival atmosphere. You're living in a thriving, sustainable one where you can create the reality that you want. From my understanding,
any other questions?
This,
anybody else?
This split is about to take place.
Hey, Russ.
At
Russ.
This moment.
Okay, she's got Sister Marva's about to make that statement. Then we got Brother Leon. Sister Marva, because we got time constraints.
Yeah, because we have to go.
Okay, I want to say one more thing.
See if you can
go on YouTube and download Rod Hayes, because he's on that parallel, and he's talking about the original indigenous organic people of the land, and that's the whole world that we exist in, and
okay.
Happening.
Okay. All right.
Brother Leon, brother.
Thank you for your comments. And sometimes I would look, because I recognize your intuitive ability, and I think you actually get a lot more insight than you're coming out with. At some time, I would like to just talk to you one-on-one so that we can discuss some of these things. So
You'll get that
please,
chance, Sister Green.
If you get my phone number, please feel free to call me. I'd love to talk to you, dear. Thank you. Thank you for calling.
Rashad, hold on for 1 minute, because Leon got something to say. He's been waiting in the wing. Go ahead, Leon. Give me 1 second,
listen,
Rashad. Go ahead.
Listen, first of all, I want to say that, I appreciate the guest, Sister Green, and the other brother that you got on. I didn't really catch his name.
Brother Russ.
Brother Russ, okay. I appreciate what they bring to the table, the information that they bring to the table, all the information that they bring to the table. My problem right now is not the information, is that your panelists don't get to chime in to comment or ask enough questions, because we are on time constraint. And so I want to go back, because I want to talk to the audience. That's what I want to do. Just briefly touch on, Sister Green, what she said. First of all, nuclear weapons, they didn't start with us. They started Inky. They started with Inky. That's where it started from, Inky. They had a nuclear war, and when they did, and when they seen the damage of it, they said that they would never do that again. Right? So, Sister Green, a lot of us on this line don't study the way you have or the way I may have. I know the story of Nibiru. I know this planet, Earth, that they call Earth, is a chip off of one of the planets that nuclear weapon that they use, they blew up a planet, and this Earth is a chip of that planet.
True,
so
yes.
I know all about Nibiru, Inki. I know that we were always here before they came here.
Wow.
They're the ones who started changing our DNA because their planet, mm-hmm. after that nuclear war, was in threat of being destroyed because they needed gold. That's why they came here, and that's why they started changing
mm-hmm.
our DNA because they needed to save their planet, so they needed workers. So they started changing our DNA so they can get us to perform the way they need us to because we wasn't of high standards. And they went at war with each other because one brother didn't want them to change our DNAs and the other ones did. So I'm familiar with that. I'm familiar with thought. I'm familiar with everything that you bring to the table, both of you. I'm familiar
okay.
with the video that you play. The video
can
that you, play. Wait a minute.
Since we only have a couple of minutes, can you give people places to go get that information, like Psychovar Sitchins or something like that? Can you tell them where to go to find to do their own research? But
no,
you're right. You're right.
This is what I want to do. This is what
right.
I want to do. I want to talk to the people that still left, that didn't leave, because
okay.
a lot of people don't believe. Now, this is what I want to say to the people that's on the line that may not believe. Let's move to the future so I can get you to understand what they have been talking about and information that they've been trying to share. And so you can believe this because you lived this era. First of all, Hitler, that's why Hitler stayed in Africa, because he was researching this and what they're talking about, because all this started in Africa. That's where Inki came. He went to Africa. So now let's move into the future. You said that Obama, you played the video of Obama telling us that he couldn't say too much. Listen, people, he couldn't say too much. You know why? Because the same thing that happened to Kennedy would have happened to him.
Amen.
And they killed, one of the reasons why they killed Kennedy is because he came across this information and he told them that he was going to expose them. And if they didn't give him the information that they needed, that he was going to expose them in the next week. Well, that week didn't last. They blew his brains out right on his wife's face. So y'all
True.
Lived that. Y'all just didn't know why these things took place. So this is what I'm going to end up in saying, because there's a lot that I could say. But this is what I want to say to the listening audience that still listen. Just think about this for those of us who don't believe what you just heard, because everything you heard is truth. Think about this for the ones who don't believe. Go to sleep tonight thinking about what is, if this is the truth. Think about that. Don't look at it that it's not and it's a bunch of hogwash. Look at it as if it is, well, wow, if this is the truth, what's going to happen next? And so
mm-hmm.
you know I always tell you guys, don't listen to anything anybody will bring to you and say, not even me, look it up for yourself. Because it's outdoor information.
I'm going to leave my number with you. I'd like to talk to you. I'd like to interview you. My number is 561-302-2588 because you got it 2,000% right. I congratulate you. What can I say but beyond that? Call me.
I'll get your number from Forrest.
Yeah,
okay.
I'll get it to the brother.
I appreciate
this.
Well,
listen, on that note, because I know Marva's going to invite you on her show. Her show starts, Brother Russ and Sister Green. I know she's going to invite you to her show, which starts next Saturday, October the 1st. She'll book the event for you for one Saturday because she's already booked up, I think she told me, for the first 2 weeks. But we're going to have you guys back on because we enjoyed this. And, like, just to piggyback off of what Brother Leon said, whether or not you believe this, family, we're bringing you things that you don't normally see on CNN, MSNBC, or whatever channel you're watching in your neck of the woods, all right? But we want you, in the words of, and I know Brother Russ is familiar with this, and Sister Green may be familiar with this artist, Lonnie Liston Smith, the jazz man, said he had a record called Expand Your Mind. That's what you have to do. That's what we bring here to you on Grown Folks Talk and Express Yourself. So listen, we're going to have an open mic after Brother Russ gets
yeah,
off.
Go.
We're going to say something real quick before Great Space. I know you got to go, but I caught that. I caught that spirit.
Well,
so I want to
say this before y'all get off. This is Adrian. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
That's Mercedes. She has her own show too, Russ. So on behalf of grown folks to Rashad, real quick. Russ, give me a minute, brother. Go ahead, brother.
Yeah, let me share this with you real quick.
Yes, sir.
First of all, I'm going to ask a question, and then I'm going to share something with you. How many listeners have ever saw a UFO or even seen an alien? Can anybody speak up?
I've seen a UFO. I've never seen an alien. I haven't seen a UFO.
I have.
Ms. Green says she has, Rashad.
I have.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Let me just share something with you. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm going to share three stories with you. And seeing is believing. If you don't see something, half the time you won't believe it. Now, I'm going to give you three incidents. 1962. I never forget this in my whole life. Somerset, New Jersey. We were visiting some people down there. In Somerset, New Jersey at that time, very dark. You could see, millions of stars in the sky. And there was about 10 of us sitting in the backyard. Everybody just chatting and, you know, having a nice time. It was nighttime. And all of a sudden, I looked up, and this other young man looked up, and we saw what looked like a falling star coming down. It was red. And then all of a sudden, it had to be a UFO. I couldn't think of anything else it was. It just came down so fast, and it just stayed up there for about 20 seconds, hovering, and it was like an orange, a huge orange color. And everybody's sitting there, like hypnotized, looking at this thing like, what the heck is that? It didn't make no sound. And then after 20 seconds, that thing took off so fast, it just disappeared, and everybody ran in the house except for me because I waited to see if it was going to come back. And then let me tell you this. No, this is a true story. I'm not making
Russ,
this.
Russ got to go. That's why I was saying, go ahead, Rashad, real quick. Go ahead, brother.
Hear this, Russ. Okay. 1965, the New York blackout. Okay, I'm in a town called Neshannock Station, New Jersey. I'm on a farm. I'm a teenager. We just finished bedding down the cows. Myself, the farmer, and this other young man, we came out the barn. And I swear, I never seen nothing like this in my life. This was even greater than the first experience. We seen six huge red balls floating in the sky in a circle of motion. No sound or nothing. And it just kept floating and just started, you know, moving and just going like north. They just kept going and going. And so we went in the house and was telling everybody what we saw. That night was a New York blackout. I never forget this. They said New York was blacked out in 1965. You can look this up. The guy, the farmer, used to get the New York Times newspaper. And I used to read a lot. And I read the New York Times newspaper the next day because I wanted to see what happened with New York. But there was a small article at the bottom of the page, inside the paper, where it said UFOs were seen on the power lines in New York. And that made my connection with what I saw that night. Okay? I don't know if these were like big probes that were out there or what, but you can never forget this stuff. This stuff, it's like, like I see it right now. You know, you never forget this stuff. It just sticks with you.
No.
And there's one last time.
Okay, good. Well, Brother Russ, if you got to go ahead because we're doing After Dark right now, brother.
Okay.
But I want to say peace and blessings to you. Hold on, Rashad. I want to say peace and blessings to you, brother, and Sister Green, if you got to go. I apologize about the overtime, but we have a very enthusiastic audience. So next time we're going to bring you on a little earlier than have the first guest on. But thank you, brother, for coming. I'll be in contact, Russ and Sister Green.
Okay, thank you, brother. Appreciate
you.
Appreciate
all
of you.
Thank
appreciate you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure with you, too.